to say it.
Well, it was interesting about those four songs to me. A few things, obviously. One is that they're thin.
Yes.
All of them. They're just thin. And as I've grown into my music roots and my love of music, I just like more full, heavier stuff. I mean, obviously, the technology was completely different, but the attitudes were there on my stuff in particular.
We heard Little Richard, Tutti Frutti? Tutti Frutti, kicked that off. And then that was followed by Since I Don't Have You by the Skyliners, followed by Maybelline. Chuck Berry, and that little set was closed off with Just to Be With You by the Passions. Tutti Frutti.
People were afraid of that man.
Yeah.
You know, he's probably that one, you know, he's that first guy where parents were like, what? No, you're not listening to that. Look at this guy.
Self-proclaimed king of rock and roll, but yeah, he also started glam.
Yeah, yeah. Unbeknownst to anybody, he probably did. You're right. He started it. You know, I mean, there would be no Prince without Chuck, without Little Richard. No Michael Jackson.
Like Bowie, man.
Yeah, or Bowie, even if you get later on into earlier on into a different decade.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. And I don't know. Tutti Frutti was one that I've heard really, Bruce do it and stuff, and I was like,
I hear Little Richard in is Creedence. Hmm. You know, you listen to like Fortunate Son or Traveling Band.
Yeah.
Traveling Man. What's it? Traveling Man. Was Ricky
Traveling
Nelson.
Band? Yeah, Traveling Band.
I hear Little Richard, man. John Fogerty was just like totally channeling Little Richard.
Hmm.
That's his inspiration right there, man. Second one was...
decades later, Bruce is like playing that in shows and stuff. You know? And it's still holding its weight, which really meant a lot to me.
I went for the doo-wop stuff, I guess the term doo-wop really wasn't coined, I guess, until the early 70s. It was some Philadelphia DJ, I believe, whose name escapes me. Always escapes me. But vocal groups.
What I dug about that is you could almost vision our parents dating in a coupe.
Yeah.
You know, and your dad's trying to slide his arm around your mom on a date at a drive-in theater or something, and that's playing in the background. That's what I always envision when I hear like a doo-wop song like that. And that was the right kind of moment, mood.
You know, again, I grew up with that stuff. It's just as much in my DNA as Zeppelin and all the other, the Stones and the Beatles and all the good stuff, you know, because that's good stuff too. But my nephew knows those songs by heart. So he's kind of brought those songs back. So
that's pretty cool.
Those songs were kind of a little nod and a wink to my nephew. It was my mother's favorite music. You know, to this day, she still loves the doo-wop and still plays it.
My mother was more of a Motown girl.
Yeah.
And she still I walked out to the car the other day. She's divided. Temptations.
My family's kind of divided on Motown. I love it. I think my mother loves some of it. My dad doesn't like it.
Wow.
Yeah. And your other song was Maybelline.
Yeah.
Chuck Berry.
Yeah. And two reasons for that. One is anybody who knows our show, we had a really good episode about that Chuck Klosterman article.
Mm-hmm.
And in 300 years, if you look back and you're teaching a class on rock and roll, is mm-hmm. Chuck Berry it? And I kind of think that it is. If you look back, you know, you're like, man. And I had the opportunity to see the guy play, and it was just a mind blowing experience. There's a million songs you can go with him.
Mm-hmm.
Just Maybelline just jumped out at me. You know, there's some really good guitar work on it. You know, to see that man just schooling other guitar players at 70, that's and even 80.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck belongs there, and
he's gotten his. You know, we talk about him pretty frequently on our show.
We do.
You know, he's come up every 5-6 episodes in a discussion. You know, it's we respect Chuck here, man. We love Chuck.
He's fucking Don Corleone. there's no other way to put it. You wanted me to play guitar? I play guitar.
I like our 60s. Segment coming up. Our 60s thing is kind of, it's very broad, I guess. Are we all over the place? Were we all over the place with I'm going to cut this part out. I'm saying. So, yeah, man, the 60s.
Well, the 60s was a little tougher.
Because how do you choose four songs from the 60s, man?
Yeah.
You know what you do? You just tell yourself we're not picking songs that are going to represent the decade. You're just picking four fucking songs that you love. Right? They could be classics. We got some. I think they're all classics.
Yeah.
In some way. One of them wasn't a hit. But one of them is. But that same song that's not a hit is kind of a cult classic among classic rock fans.
One of them has a birthday
that's
coming
your
up.
Your song
is it the birthday, the one that has a birthday coming up, or the cult? The other one could be the cult. I don't know. Without further ado,
yeah.
Here's the 60s.
So let's go to the 60s. Let's go back in time.
And you said it best. Who the hell follows Martha and the Vandellas with Pink Floyd? The probably one of the most
we do
psychedelic Floyd songs on the planet Earth. We're right. We do. We did. There it is. We did it.
Yeah.
You had my head bopping with that Martha too, man. That's a really good one.
That is just one of my very favorite songs ever. Not even of the 60s, just ever.
It moves. It just keeps you moving. Tap your foot. Bop your head.
You know, they say the Supremes, the Supremes had the hits.
Yep.
The Supremes were one of the very few American acts, other than the Beach Boys and the Four Seasons, to rival the Beatles on the pop charts in 1964, 65. But Martha and the Vandellas, man, Heat Wave.
Could you imagine being around when that was playing on the radio?
Hearing
and,
that
you
for the first time,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, dropping a needle on that record must have just been mind-blowing.
Yeah, no words, man, no words. Then we went into the Pink Floyd song, the Syd Barrett era Pink Floyd from their very first record that was recorded in the same studio, Abbey Road,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
While the Beatles were recording Sgt. Pepper's.
And it's a
Pink
shame.
Floyd, we're recording Piper at the Gates of Dawn.
During the time of the Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah.
It's just a shame that Syd Barrett, that everything turned out the way it did for Syd Barrett. Because, I'd be curious to see where that
but
band
would have
went.
It's also a blessing, though.
It is.
That kind of,
I mean, that's as psychedelic as that band really got. I mean, later on, I think the LSD movement made it a little different, I think.
Yeah.
In the way psychedelia sounded.
Yeah. They got much darker.
Yeah.
They were always dark, but
that stuff was more flower child's, like, you know what I mean? You were in pastel colors.
It was like troll music or something.
As great as it is, it's, you know, and Bicycle and stuff like that. Yeah. I mean, there was some really good trippy stuff that they put out. I love where they progressed, though. Mm-hmm. I love where they went, is what I should say.
Yeah.
And hey, I guess that is that's the downside of the Syd Barrett tragedy.
Mm-hmm. There's always casualties, man.
Yeah,
casualties.
Yeah.
He was just a living casualty, man.
He really was. He just wigged.
You guys out there do the math, because that brings us into our next segment, the 1970s. The 1970s, man.
Wow.
You really went for the ball-breaking, the ball-blistering electric guitar of Alex Lifeson. I mean, like Working Man.
Oh, my
That's
God.
Just like, and then but you started it off with something really cool.
Yeah, but I want to continue the moment of Working Man, because we can just bounce around. The four songs, they've played already.
We heard Friends from Led Zeppelin. We heard a song called Magnet and Steel by Walter Egan.
Good song.
And then we heard Working Man by Rush, and that was followed by Gold by Jon Stewart.
It took me to the chorus to remember that song.
Let's go back to your opening song of Friends.
Underrated song.
Yeah.
A hugely underrated record, and I think a really underrated Zeppelin song.
Yeah.
Zeppelin wasn't always they didn't always have to be that blistering guitar. When you had like that light little thing going on in the background, and John Paul Jones was doing his thing rhythmically, and so was John Bonham. it just, you know, that the powerhouse could still be a powerhouse without all the big heavy volume. And yeah. And that song just, I don't know, I could hear it and just, it's a foot tapper, man. It really is.
I think we've talked about Zeppelin a number of occasions on our show.
Sure.
But I don't know if I've ever expressed that. You know, maybe I have. I'm not, I love all their albums. Let me just get that off the bat. But my favorites, my least favorite, shoot me, my least favorite are the first two records. Zeppelin for me begins with Zeppelin 3.
Wow.
They hadn't really purged all of that blues stuff out yet, you know, they really, but Zeppelin 3, you say underrated song, Friends, it's an underrated record.
Yeah,
the whole
absolutely.
Album, man.
Agree.
I never get sick of Zeppelin 3. I get sick of Zeppelin 1 and 2, not never Zeppelin 3.
I get sick of the radio play for those first two records.
Well,
because they
that's
saturate
why.
The radio with songs that you just, I don't want to hear a whole lot of love anymore. I just,
yeah.
Not anymore, but I don't want to hear it every fucking day.
Right.
At 10:30 a.m. on Q104.
Right.
I just don't. And that's sad.
This song that you didn't know. Wait, you did know it. Did
Magnet,
you know Magnet,
right?
And Steel?
Yeah, Magnet and Steel, I do know.
I did.
It's a karaoke classic.
Listen, I had, this is funny because, well, it's not funny, but.
It's funny.
I kind of study the pop charts. I'm just weird that way. Okay. Like I've always studied the pop charts, the Billboard charts, especially in the 70s. That's kind of like my area where I'm just fascinated by the trends on the pop charts of in the 1970s. Crazy, crazy shit going on in that decade, which, you know, we could build another show around, but I could write a fucking book about it. Just 1974 alone, just the weird shit. Horrible music. Horrible. Probably the worst year in music. Until like the 21st century. But that's another discussion. Where was I going with this? Oh yeah. So I keep seeing, every time I like look at 1978, there's a song Magnet and Steel, Magnet and Steel. This song Magnet and Steel, I always see in print somewhere when I'm looking at something involving the pop charts of the summer of 1978. Okay. I have very vivid memories of the summer of 78. I was 8 years old. I think of being in the back seat of the 1974 Pontiac Catalina driving to Florida, going to Disney World, and it's all Baker Street, and It's a Heartache by Bonnie Tyler, and what else? There was, you know, Grease.
Yeah.
And Miss You by the Stones, and
My Trips Were
Shadow Dancing by Andy Gibb, and there's this song Magnet and Steel, which I don't remember. I had no memory of this song, so I had to look it up. I was like, okay, Magnet and Steel, let me hear this thing once and for all. And it was like this forgotten
gem
song from I remember back in 1986 hearing the Vinnie Vincent Invasion album when I was 16. It was I didn't like it. I threw it away. But there was this song called Back on the Streets. And this song, Back on the Streets, reminded me of something. It took me 30 years. I could never place
it,
what it reminded me of. And it was Magnet and Steel.
Wow.
And that was it. Just this, you know, this sweet love song, man. Very corny in the lyrics. You are the magnet, I am the steel. Sounds almost like Gene Simmons, you know, a hot knife through butter. You know, you're the garage, I'm the car. You know,
it is a karaoke classic too. I you know me, yeah. You as well.
I don't know that I've ever heard it in karaoke.
I'm gonna get.
You say our
there's
our
a friend of ours that would that does it. I will get him to do it next time
okay.
we see him.
Yeah. But I played the hell out of that song over the summer, and I told myself this is going to be one of my Christmas episode songs, because it's just like, I mean, does everybody? I don't think of that as this big classic from that summer. All the classics were like Shadow Dancing, Baker Street,
yeah.
Things like that. Plus, the guy's obviously a one-hit wonder, right? I can't think of any. I mean, I don't remember the guy Walter Egan for anything,
no.
You know. But then now I know his name. So now I kind of went and discovered that song, and I liked it enough. You know, there is something corny about it, but it's a lovable corny, you know?
I had no problems with it being
there. I love the harmonies, the melody. Great song.
Like you said, though, I just went in opposite direction.
You went, and then comes Working Man.
I put the fucking hammer to the anvil for that one, bro.
You know, I just felt like smoking a cigar or like... lifting weights or doing like drinking a beer or just doing something manly after coming from Magnet and Steel and getting into this possibly like one of the heaviest Rush songs.
Yeah, you know, ever. And Rush was, I love Rush. Saw them multiple times. Love that band. And when you hear something like that from them, you're like, whoa. And then where they went was a completely different direction too. I mean, you know, they had some changes, but you know, it might have been either Neil or somebody in that band had once said, he goes, well, what do you want us to do? Continue to put out the same record year after year? No, I don't want that. I don't. And they're right on about it. It's great to go revisit those classics. But I love where that band ended up. And when they finally called it quits, I do. They had some flops there. They absolutely did. They were experimenting, trying things out, whatever.
I don't dislike anything Rush did until the 80s, till like the second half of the 80s, really.
The late 80s, I agree. The late 80s, there was some shit that was like, meh, I could live without it. But Working Man, when I thought 70s, I was like, that's going to be it.
70s, Rush is great.
Has to be an era where there's some punch to it, is what I thought. And that's where I went with it, was with that one. That's my and I've been dying to get Rush. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I've been dying to get Rush into my Christmas show since we started it.
Yeah. We owe Rush some time because they don't get enough time on the show. And not even really, I mean, I don't even remember if we've ever really discussed
three or four times we might have mentioned them.
We've brought up Rush.
Yeah, we've brought them up, but because I think you haven't seen them, right? And they were one of the bands that you regret not seeing.
Yeah, Rush. I really wanted to see Rush. If Rush plays again, man, I'm definitely gonna go. Make it a point to go, because that's basically what I'm doing now. I'm pretty much done with concerts. I have no urge to see concerts anymore, but there are groups and artists that I would see that. You know, this past year I wanted to see ELO. I didn't get a chance to see them. I never saw Jackson Browne until this past year. Got a chance to see him. So next year ELO is coming back. I went another territory. I kind of went mellow again.
Right.
Basically in the same kind of brand of hit song that Magnum and Steel was, but this just kind of gets into the excess of that whole, I guess, Laurel Canyon, West Coast, you know, music industry scene. A song called Gold by a guy named John Stewart, who goes back to the Kingston Trio, back in the early, the folk revival of the early 60s. And he had a hit in 1979 called Gold. Can you guess how my two songs are linked? Like what they have in common?
I have no idea.
This is big.
The second one, I hardly remembered it until I heard the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
But no,
and the answer is both in the chorus.
I have no idea.
Well, at the time, Stevie Nicks was the go-to person for background vocals. And she was,
wow.
I mean, she does the background vocals for both songs.
Wow.
Just that definitive harmony in the chorus of Magnet and Steel and Gold.
That's killer. Great common thread.
Both songs, Stevie Nicks, background vocals. But, I mean, she was like the it girl. 1970, like after Rumors, between Rumors and Tusk, man, Kenny Loggins went to her.
Wonder if Iovine had anything to do with that, because he was producing a lot of stuff then.
Who?
Jimmy Iovine. And he was dating her, too.
Possibly.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I mean, you know, we needed some background vocals. Yeah. I mean, he says, I got your girl.
Yeah.
I mean, it's famous.
And, I mean, she was on, like, three or four hit songs between the run of Rumors. Rumors had its run on the pop charts. Tusk hadn't come out yet. Whenever Tusk came out in 79. And Stevie was on like four hit songs between Fleetwood Mac albums, just doing background vocals. I mean, you know, at this time, 40 years ago, she had that song. She had a song with Kenny Loggins, a song I never liked.
Riley and I just listened to Rumors 3 days ago. Put the whole the record on.
Yeah,
I got her, made record. Her get up and flip the record, and wow, that was a hell of an era.
Drama going on with Fleetwood Mac now, man.
Yeah, like,
Lindsey Buckingham just came out and did an interview, basically said Stevie was the one that was responsible for him coming out of the band. Oh, by the way, you said Neil before, talking about Neil Peart.
Peart, yeah.
Made me think of something. I got two big notifications this week. One, I mean, and it's bullshit, but I've got a whopping, it said, congratulations, you have a whopping 25 followers on Twitter. I was like, okay, thanks. Insult to injury. And then my 26th follower is Neil Young.
No.
Neil
shit.
Young. Neil Young is following me on Twitter. Like, why? What does Neil Young want with me?
Is there a little blue circle with the check mark that is verified?
Yeah, it's the official shit. Neil Young site.
Wow.
Now, what I think, I don't know if I liked something or if I simply followed him or what. I know I was on his Twitter, and I must have, maybe I followed him.
Wow.
But this morning I got a thing, Neil Young followed you.
That's killer.
Now, it's not Neil Young, obviously. Somebody represents him.
Sure.
You know. But I thought
it's
that
still
was pretty,
making
pretty
him
cool.
look good.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's making me look good. It's making me look good.
Let me put this truck into third gear and get into the decade that there was debauchery in my world. The '80s is when I really started to hit my stride, and things took a turn, maybe for the worse. I don't know, but it made me the man I am today. 1980s, baby. Here they are.
That depressing shit, man. What a way to end the 80s. That was, you know, in 1989 was some of the better albums, and as far as I'm concerned, some of the better albums from the 80s came out in 1989, and that was one of them. But let's go back to the beginning of our run.
Well, once again, here I come crashing through the wall like the fucking Kool-Aid man.
Yeah, well, you know.
But
you're not a big Lou fan.
No, I'm not.
You're,
but
admittedly,
that being
you're
said,
on record.
People know that I like the heavier stuff. There's no, it's no secret to anybody listening to me. And I'd like to think that in the course of this show, I went a little bit outside my comfort zone, especially in the 50s and I guess the 60s too. The 80s, though, I'm not going out of my comfort zone.
80s is your decade, right? Is it safe to say that the 80s? Yeah.
Yeah, the 80s, I found my niche. And, you know,
you and me, we came from the same place in terms of music. We have the same influences. We have the same. I think you definitely like the heavier stuff in the 80s.
Yes,
and I like the heavier stuff too. But my I went outside that. That's where I went outside my comfort zone is in the 80s.
I think I did that more in the, believe it or not, the 2000s.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the 2000s, I really had to stretch a little
bit.
Well,
I just started going back. I mean, I meant going back and listening to stuff that was outside of my comfort zone and respect, and having a different respect for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the 80s, I was locked in, laser-focused. I was listening to Black Sabbath. I was listening to, obviously, Van Halen. I was listening to freaking, you know, the newer stuff that was coming out at that point was like the Slayers of the world and the Anthraxes of the world, the Testaments of the world, the Metallicas of the world. You know, I just jumped on that real quick. I was like, whoa, what is this? Okay. And coming from my Kiss roots, I felt that it was a natural progression for me.
Yeah.
I really did. You know, Maiden was still around, obviously, and, you know.
We heard Lady Evil.
You know.
Some Dio, Black Sabbath.
I've done Sabbath before on a Christmas show.
Yes.
I did Wizard.
Was that the first year?
Might have been.
Yeah, that was like your second song in the first year, I think.
I just had to get Ozzy playing that harmonica into the show.
It was one of them. It wasn't your second, but it was in your first show.
And this time around, I had to get Ronnie in there. I mean, you know, Dio deserves to be, he deserves everything that he gets, and he doesn't get much, I don't think.
Yeah.
I know that, you know, there's stories now that they guess they're going to tour around with like a hologram of them or something.
Are they?
I don't know. I thought I read that, but there was also a band doing this, the Dio tunes, and I think Vivian's in a part of it. So it's just, I don't know, man. The guy, he was just a nice guy. He was like a nice rock guy. You know what I mean? You never really heard anything bad about Dio at all. I mean, everybody had like those songs, like the We Are the World type songs and stuff. He put one together with all those metal artists, stars. We're stars. It was just. You know, that was Dio's thing, and I wanted to pay my respects to my boy Dio, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a fucking awesome album. There's no way around it. It's a fucking awesome album.
Heaven and Hell?
Yeah, it's fucking awesome. Yeah, I should have said the title of the record, I guess, right?
What do you is that a better album than Mob Rules?
In my opinion, like, yes, that? I like it more.
Yeah,
I like it more, and it's, I think it's a debate. It's, you know, between Black Sabbath fans, you either like that one or the other one. I like Heaven and Hell more.
You know, and you notice I'm not saying anything. Not because I don't like it.
You like Mob Rules
no,
more?
No. Because I've never really listened to either of those. I mean, I've heard Heaven and Hell.
Yeah.
And I've always been curious about Dio, Sabbath with Dio. I just never got around to it. You know, but I know those two. I know those two records. I would just always kind of, and I know they were both big.
They were. Absolutely.
They were both big.
I was always wondering,
what's the one to get? You know, if you had to get one
of those two,
I would guess Heaven and Hell.
But if you took, let's say you took 30 of us in a room,
right,
and we're big Black Sabbath fans and fans of both of those records, to be honest with you, it might lean towards Mob, but
really,
I would say it's gonna be closer to half and half. I would. I'm going to go out on a
limb
there.
Both albums are equally great.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah.
They're both fucking barn burners, man. They're both barn burners.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, just two killer albums and he got out. Sometimes that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
He made his niche.
It's a good stepping stone. You know, and he ended up bigger than the band. Ozzy and Dio were, you know, I mean, Sabbath couldn't get arrested after that.
No, I know. they had a rough little run there.
Yeah.
Until Rick Rubin produced that 13 record when all the original guys got back together again, and it was fucking good.
I guess that was that. Yeah, that was followed by Girls Talk.
Linda Ronstadt, right?
Girls Talk.
And I was not familiar with that record.
Let me just Google something here, really quick. I have a lot of editing to do. A song called Girls Talk. Linda Ronstadt, you know, she was probably, and I've probably said this on the show, probably in terms of modern pop music, the rock era, the modern pop era from the 1950s onward, in my opinion, the greatest covers artist.
Okay.
Talk about making a cover song your own.
You wouldn't say Joe Cocker, huh?
No. There weren't enough. What did he do besides like his definitive Beatles cover and the Officer and a Gentleman 20 years later?
He did some good covers, man. I'm trying to.
No, I know. I know. Joe, I mean, Joe, I'm not dissing Joe Cocker. I'm just saying, like, as far as like a representative body of work where. I mean, the 70s, I mean, you could say like...
Oh, she was the queen of the 70s, without
she
a doubt.
Owned, as far as female artists go...
She owned the 70s.
She owned the 70s.
She absolutely did. And she was in with all the right people, the guys from the Eagles, the country influences
in the beginning, you know, and then she kind of got into a pop thing. And she put out this album, one of my favorites. It might be my favorite record of hers from the 70s, because I love her 70s records, each and every one of them. Are worth having, and I don't say this about covers. I generally don't like covers. I don't like when my favorite artists cover a song,
right?
But she kind of made a career out of cover music, you know. And when you think about that, there's not too many artists that were that successful, you know, doing that and making those songs her own. Like she almost had the definitive versions of almost every song she covered. Not all of them. You know, some of them obviously like Blue Bayou, you know, the songs that, you know, Roy Orbison did.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up hearing her version.
Right.
You know, You're No Good.
Right.
Her version. That's the definitive version, man.
As a kid of the 70s, that's what it was the earworm.
It's So Easy, the Buddy Holly song. You know, there were just so many great ones. But she put out this album called Mad Love in 1980.
That song brings back a lot of memories.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you know, So Easy.
Nick Lowe, Elvis Costello, that whole thing. You know, Elvis Costello wrote a lot of songs for her on that record.
Hey, I wasn't aware of that. You let me know that before we went on air.
It's like the last classic Linda Ronstadt album before she got into the Nelson Riddle thing in the 80s. So I wanted to go with that. And you came back. With Waldo.
Like I always do. 1984 by Van Halen was... I did another one off of this record, too, in another Christmas show. I think I did Panama.
Yeah.
That record just, to me, speaks 80s.
Mm-hmm.
It's got 80s washed all over it.
Yep.
the flashy guitar, the fucking front man, it had it all. It did. I can't say enough good things about that record. It's not their best record, but to me, and I was 14. I mean, it was, you know what I mean? Or no, I was 12, maybe 13. Right? It was 80.
That was the summer of 84, I guess. Like, oh, so that's the beginning 14. Of like freshman year.
Yeah, I was 14. Yeah. So I mean, it just, I can remember like certain moments of my life to that song, being that teenager in that phase where like you don't know whether you're coming or going, literally, you know what I mean? You were trying different things and smoking different things, and you know, girls became relevant, like really relevant, and that just, the whole record just brings me to a point in my life that was I could go one way or the other, and I went the other. I definitely went the other. But hey, you know me, it's got to be hard, it's got to be heavy, it's got to be guitar. I love that shit, man. Love it. Again, I didn't even really get heavy on this fucking whole Christmas special. There's no Slayer, there's no Anthrax. Could have been.
Yeah, no, you went with like the core important hard rock bands of those of each particular era. You know, Rush, Zeppelin, very representative of the 70s in terms of hard rock, Van Halen.
People might look at it as milk and cookies, 80s, but man. It's, you know, I thought I picked a decent song that represented that group from that era. I mean, 70s, I could have threw Van Halen in the 70s easily, but yeah. what was I going to, what Van Halen song was going to knock Working Man out and Friends by Zeppelin? What
from the 70s?
Yeah.
Well, no Van Halen song is going to knock any Zeppelin song out, but no. You know, if you just wanted to go head to head and just put something equally as brilliant, you know, anything off the first record, if you're talking 70s, anything off the first two records. But I mean, see, my problem with Led Zeppelin, my problem with Van Halen has always been, one of my problems with Van Halen, as great as the music is, was their sound. Their sound has always been too thin and trebly for me.
Okay.
There was never enough bottom.
I have that. I have that issue with older music.
Like you were saying, of the 50s, yeah, the stuff in the 50s.
Yeah, definitely.
That's my issue with Van Halen. You know, I like Van Halen. I don't love Van Halen. There are Van Halen songs that I love.
Yeah.
There are Van Halen songs that I love enough to put on like a top whatever list.
Sure.
You know, I've always loved Panama. I've always loved I'll Wait.
Talking
about that record,
yeah.
I love their first Top record. Jimmy. You know, Little Dreamer is probably, you know, now 100 songs is not a lot. It's not a lot by any means.
Right.
When we did those 100 songs on Facebook, when we were posting 100. Songs on it, you know, like everybody's like, that's a lot. 100, that's a big
really
commitment.
Wasn't.
100 was nothing. I was just like, shit, there's still 200 more songs.
Yeah.
But Little Dreamer would make my... If I had to make a top 100 songs, Little Dreamer would be on it. And I'm not a Van Halen fan. You know, I haven't said a lot of good about Van Halen in my life. You know, but it's but you got to acknowledge.
I don't think they care.
But you know what? That brings us to my last song of the '80s was
my favorite person
Lou
on
Reed,
the planet.
Hold On, from the New York album. Now. Where can I go with this? All right, so let me just like stay on Lou Reed, and then I'll go into the broader picture of 1989. New York was easily one of Lou's three best records. It's probably my favorite Lou record. I'm not going to say it's his best record, but it's my favorite record.
I will
but
have to take
also,
your word on that.
It's also very dated. It's become very dated. When it came out, it was brilliant, man. Every word, it was like a rap artist, man. Like why you listen to rap for like the lyrics, because
sure.
I can't stand the sound
of
you know, the lyrical, just the brilliant lyrics that Lou was spitting out on that record. It was an important record for its time because New York was just coming out of the Koch era, the Koch 80s into. You know, the Dinkins era.
It's a bigger shit show.
I mean, you had Crown Heights. You had the Tompkins Square riots. You had, in the summer of 1989, Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing come out, and it was reflective of the climate in New York City 1988-89, man. Do the Right Thing, to me, is one of the top 10 greatest movies ever made.
That's the one with Radio Raheem, right?
It's that movie. I hope to be talking about that movie a little bit more in the coming year, because we're going to be looking at the 30th anniversary of Do the Right Thing and Public Enemy, not Public Enemy as a group or as, you know, by any means, not by any means, but it was, you know, it was Fight the Power.
Yeah.
And that whole thing, and the introduction of Rosie Perez, man, and just a whole cultural explosion in one summer. That was just a great time, man. You know, I was getting into New York City. I was hanging out in New York City, by myself for the first time in my life. I was 19. A lot of the 60s artists who had totally just like slacked off all through the 70s and 80s were coming back.
Yeah.
You know, Bob Dylan had Oh Mercy. It was his best album in like over a decade. You know, Neil Young had put out Freedom, his best album in over
really
a decade.
Song.
And
yeah,
Neil
really
Young and Lou Reed comes along with New York. Important record, man, but it was also very dated to its time.
He always
man.
Reminded me of Scott Muni. Whenever I think of
Lou Reed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scott Muni just adored him and loved to play him. And it always made me.
It just, you know, the New York record, it just reads like a history book, man. You know, if you could get past the music and Lou's voice, man, it's just like if you, like what was New York City like in 1977? Well, you watch Summer of Sam and you look at clips of the Yankees 1977 season, like we talked about on Retrospeak.
The blackout, even. Yeah, it's,
what was
it was
New
a wild
York,
time. New York City was a wild place, man.
Yeah. But what was New York like at the end of the 80s, in 1989 in particular, 1988 in particular? You watch Do the Right Thing and you listen to Lou Reed's album, New York. So that's all I'll say about that. And that's all I got to say about that. So.
Now we can move to a pretty important era for me.
You once listed the 90s, and I quoted you. I actually quoted you in my first. I quoted you somewhere, man, as saying that the 90s. You once said the 90s was our playground. Do you remember saying that?
Yeah, I think I do. Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
You didn't say it on the podcast.
I just said it out at the bar.
You
one
said
night.
It at the bar one night, and I was just like.
I think that's fair to say that.
Profound, man.
I think it's fair to say that. It was my playground for certain.
Yeah.
I know you were just saying that you were hanging out in the city in like, you know, 88, 89. The path that I chose, that other path, led me to be hanging out in the city much earlier than that. 86, being 16. Yeah. Me and a couple buds ended up in Central Park and doing stupid things and. That still wasn't the playground because you weren't old enough to do what you really wanted to do. And you were just young enough to slide under the radar.
Yeah.
Whereas the 90s for me, holy Christ, I did more things in the 90s that I would never talk about or repeat than in any other decade. And that's all I got to say about that. Just in case my daughter's listening. So with that, here's the 90s. The Devil's Playground.
Our playground.
The 90s. Things were happening in the 90s, man. We turned 21. We could drink legally. Which meant a lot. Didn't mean anything because I was already illegally drinking. I looked older than I was. Had a really good fake ID.
So we heard My Wave by Soundgarden. We heard a band called Yola Tango, and a song called Upside Down from an album called Pleased to Meet Me. No, Pleased to Meet Me, duh. What am I saying? That's The Replacements. May I Sing With Me from 1993, one of my favorite songs from them. It's probably my favorite record from them, although I don't have their entire collection. I kind of lost touch with them, but there was a brief period where I was listening to them, and that album, I guess it's kind of one that doesn't really get talked about. And that was followed by Animal by Pearl Jam, and then a song called It Takes Time by Patti Smith and Fred Sonic Smith, the only song that they played that they recorded together. But let's go back to My Wave.
I needed to get Soundgarden into this list probably last year. Just a tragic, tragic loss that guy has been to the rock community, man. It hurts my soul. And, you know, I mean, we spent some time, you know, with Mike Surjak talking about Soundgarden in the 90s, and, you know, because he was playing in that era, and even Pearl Jam. And I, you know, I gave that slight edge to Pearl Jam, and I still do from that era. But man, that record by Soundgarden, I couldn't stop playing that when I was DJing. And you know, when you get that record, you know, when you get a record in general, you listen to it through and you want to hear what's this, what's that. So the record was still fresh, but My Wave was the one song on that record that stuck out to me. You know, there was a slew of hits on it, but for some reason, My Wave just like, it was the one that punched. I was like, whoa, that really cool guitar thing that they got going on in it. It hit me like a ton of bricks. And when everybody was, I can't remember, was it Spoon Man, I think, was the first hit on that record, maybe?
Yeah, Super Unknown came out. Spoon Man was the first single.
Everybody was kind of requesting that, and I was like, "No, I'm gonna push for this," and I did. And you know, it's not even their best. I guess maybe it is their best album. I don't know about critically, but from the money standpoint, it probably is. I personally think Bad Motor Fingers is just a fucking ripping record. But that My Wave, I just, like I said, I put it in there because I specifically remember pushing that song. That's the one I wanted people to hear. And it did well. It did well because it moved, and it wasn't Black Hole Sun. I can remember somebody coming up and requesting it. I was like, really? That's as great as it is. It's like a little down, and you know, it mellow, and it's not going to keep people interested. And that was my job as a DJ, were to keep people interested and spend money. You weren't there to fucking lollygag. You were there to spend money. That was my goal.
Yeah,
that's my story. That
Bad Motor Finger was the one where everybody kind of went crazy over. Well, like our friend Stick Nixon was preaching Soundgarden at Bad Motorfinger.
Yeah.
And it took me a while before I really got into Soundgarden. And I got into them at Super Unknown, and that was the record. My Wave was, was at the beginning of the record. And when I heard that, I was like, yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I thought that they could have been the next Black Sabbath when I first heard them. And that's like on like a song called Big Dumb Sex, you know, even before Bad Motorfinger. I was like, wow, these guys could be the next fucking Black Sabbath. They had like that, a power vocal. I mean, not that Ozzy had a power vocal, but a higher range vocal.
They had all of the right elements for a hard rock band.
Yeah.
That the bands in the 70s had. And even though they were part of that, I guess, like Pacific Northwest thing,
mm-hmm.
They had that unique, they just had all the elements were there. And why is my vocal track not being loud anymore? Check, check, check. That's weird. Anyway, am I still here? Yeah, I'm still here to a certain degree. Let me crank that up. Check, 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 check. Okay, there we go. That's weird. But anyway, that was followed by, what was my set? Oh, yeah, so I talked about Yola Tango a little bit, Upside Down. That puts us into Pearl Jam, Animal. Man, you first.
All right, two things. One, again, going back to the DJ thing. That album was due to come out. When did they release albums? On like Tuesdays or something back in the day.
Yeah.
There was a specific day. Yeah. Soundarama in Rahway. Hal, he knew I was a DJ. I was always in there buying CDs and records, blah, 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 blah. Pearl Jam did, for that record, for the Versus record, they were going to release it on vinyl first and then CD like a day or two later.
Right.
I'm in there begging, 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 begging. He gives me the album the night before it's released, and I debut it that night at the bar. And people are losing their shit over it. And that's the song that I premiered at the bar that night, was that one. And people just lost their shit over it. They were like, yeah. Second thing is, I feel like this was the album where Pearl Jam, you know, they wrote this stuff still getting super tight with each other. Some of the guys already were. on the road and stuff like that, and they were really digging into their roots and what this band was going to become, I think, was the Versus album. I think they pushed that forward from there. As good as the first album is.
I wasn't a big fan of the first record, but I got into them on the first record. When Versus came out, I was preaching Pearl Jam, and I was preaching that record. That's how much I loved it. It was
brutal.
I played the shit out of Versus when it came out, and it was just like, yeah, this is finally, because I mean, Nirvana, you know, didn't hit me the way it hit everybody else. I liked it. I didn't love it, and I didn't love 10 when Pearl Jam first, you know, when Pearl Jam put out 10. I didn't love, to this day, I don't love 10. I like it, but Versus to me is the best thing they ever did. They were never that good again. Vitalogy, there's good stuff on Vitalogy.
I like Vitalogy even more than Versus.
There's good stuff on No Code, but this is when they were started hanging out with Neil Young.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I like Vitalogy better than Versus, actually. And
yeah,
I love
Versus.
It's arguably,
you could say it's better. I'm not, you know.
It's a matter of opinion, right?
Yeah.
The guy up the road might say No Code is their best album. Yeah. Or you know.
I love No Code too. You know, that's where they kind of lost me at Yield. But
Yield was a strange record.
Yeah.
It's got its picks on it.
Versus, man.
Everything Versus. On it. Every
Just
song.
Beginning to end.
Yep.
And it's funny because when I talk about not being really grabbed by the balls by anything that's come out in the past 25 years, I really mean it. For a long time, until I heard The Strokes' Is This It in 2001, it had been almost 10 years since Versus had come out, and Versus was the last album that really grabbed me by the balls, man. And then when I heard The Strokes' Is This It, I was like, this is the first album I've really loved by anybody since Versus.
Wow.
I mean, you know, there were a lot of great albums that came out in the 90s, but like that was like Versus is easily my favorite album of the 90s.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm glad it made its way in there.
Yeah.
There's no way in hell, and people could excuse me. People could kill me for putting Soundgarden and Pearl Jam as my two songs. They can fucking hammer me all they want.
Yeah,
but in my opinion, they were two of the best bands that came out of the 90s. The probably two best bands that came out of the 90s.
Mm.
I'm sorry, Mike Surjak. I give Pearl Jam a slight edge.
What did Surjak say?
He said Soundgarden.
Soundgarden?
Yeah.
See, I mean,
you can't go wrong.
You know, my favorite band of the 90s, my favorite album of the 90s is Versus. My favorite band of the 90s might be a band called Stereolab. It's got nothing to do with any of, you know, what came out of Seattle. I mean, they were nowhere near that. You know, they sung half of their shit in French, you know. But that was another band that I equally loved in the 90s, man. They put out some really good records. But, I mean, Versus was just like, it was like the Zeppelin 4 of the 90s to me, you know. Maybe the Zeppelin 4 of the 90s is maybe, what, Nevermind.
Yeah.
But.
Okay, Sergeant Pepper of the 90s.
Sergeant Pepper of the 90s. Wow. That might be a Stereolab record. No, I don't know. The Sergeant Pepper of the 90s would like if Dark Side of the Moon was the you're not going to like what I'm going to say. But if I had to pick one of those records, I think the Sergeant Pepper of the 90s was OK Computer.
Oof.
Yeah.
I really don't like that statement at all.
Because they broke ground on that record.
Oh.
They were.
Let me go in the corner and shoot heroin.
Yeah.
I love you, Mike, but you know when we disagree. You know what's crazy? Before you get to your next song, when we agree full tilt, both feet in the water in the pool. But when we disagree, it's just like we really disagree.
Yeah. No, I'm just talking about records that just kind of really broke ground that weren't like derivative.
There's nothing wrong with
that,
man.
And you know. And I think what Radiohead did, and I'm not a Radiohead fan. I like Radiohead, but I don't love Radiohead. I didn't care for Radiohead up until OK Computer. When OK Computer came out, it just kicked my ass.
That fucking record is the critic's darling.
Paranoid Android. But my problem with OK Computer is that everything great about OK Computer happens in the first three songs, happens in the first 15 minutes, and then it just, the album's just such a bummer after that, and I can't listen to it.
I think they're, all their songs are bummer.
I don't know. Paranoid Android, you don't even like that? No?
No, thanks.
That was like, I don't know. That, I don't know. It was,
hey, it's, they're the critics' darling for a reason. They really are.
Yeah.
I'm just, it's too much for me.
That was as close to Bohemian Rhapsody as anybody ever got, man. Like, wow. as far as putting like something so groundbreaking on a record, man, that was just new, refreshing, and just took the whole fucking thing. Sorry, Riley.
She can't hear
it. Into it just pushed it forward, man. One of those, Paranoid Android was one of those songs, man. Like, okay, how do you top this, man? But enough about Radiohead. They're not even in our show. Fuck you, Tom York.
How good are they? They didn't make our list.
Yeah, but my last song there was It Takes Time. It was a little thing that, there was a soundtrack. There was a movie in 1992-93 called Until the End of the World. It was a very small movie. I think it was an independent film. I don't even think it made it to New Jersey. It was like one of those movies that played in major cities like L.A. and New York. But it had a really killer soundtrack. And the soundtrack on FM radio, if you were listening to like NEW in 1992-93, the soundtrack was like treated like an event. Wow. You had, and because you had, like, again, a bunch of critics, darlings, bands.
Sure.
R.E.M., Patti Smith, Talking Heads,
all critics, critically
acclaimed artists. But it was a really great, great, great soundtrack. And it was the only time that Patti Smith and her husband, Fred Sonic Smith of the MC5, recorded a song together. And it's the only time that I know of, I might be wrong, where Fred, is his voice is heard, where he does a vocal, but it's all talking. So it's just like this really mystical meditation. That I loved and I wanted to use at some point for something. And I was like looking for something.
You found your spot.
Yeah, I found something from like something kind of rare and obscure from the 90s. I didn't want to do obvious things. So that's why I went with Yola Tango and the Patti Smith song.
I went obvious.
Yeah. So, I mean, for the 2000s, you know, when we get into the 2000s, everybody knows from our show that I'm not a big fan of the 2000s, man. I mean, the bands and artists that I like from the past 18 years, or even in the late 90s, 25 years, are very few and far between. You could count them on one hand and have fingers left over. And
I have one by an artist that I absolutely love.
It goes back
love.
To the 70s.
Yeah, I absolutely love him.
So what does that say?
Yeah, I worked him in. And the other band, you might consider them, some could say they're a super group.
Yeah.
A small little super group, a trio.
So let's get into the 2000s and see what we have.
All right, so the songs that we have are...
Well, you could just announce them if you want. All right. Because you're kind of, you could say like, okay, those were, list like all four of them.
Yeah.
And we can go back and dissect them.
So we heard Living in the Future by Bruce Springsteen, an artist of the 70s and 80s and 90s, and worked its way into our 2000s set list. That was interesting.
Had to throw that up there.
That was followed by Machu Picchu by The Strokes. And as much as I love that first record by The Strokes, Is This It? That one comes off their fourth record, a record called Angles. And I chose that because it's my favorite song by The Strokes. So there.
And then we had Elevate by the Winery Dogs.
Winery Dogs.
Could be considered a super group if you
it's
look at it.
It's a great album, man.
It really is such a great album.
It's a great album. I'm glad you turned me on to that.
And that was followed by...
Transatlanticism by a band called Death Cab for Cutie.
Wow.
So I guess we'll start with Living in the Future.
A song that...
definitely speaks to its time.
Excuse me, I have something in my throat. I have to clear my throat there. Way ahead of its time, that song, right?
Of its time. Of its time and ahead of its time. Yeah, well, yeah.
The political climate then was bad, but it's shitty now. And we're not a political show, and we're not going to get too much into it.
We're not a political show, but you know what? I just reject the idea that we're not supposed to talk politics when it comes to rock music, man. I think
60s and 70s was all about politics.
Just the best art was all informed by politics.
Sure was.
And vice versa, man. Art is politics, man. And Bruce Springsteen wrote that song as a reaction to the Bush administration in the Bush years and saying, you know, like, what could possibly happen here in America? Well, it's happened.
Sure as shit did, didn't it?
It's happened.
Now, not only that, but, okay, I picked that song because I really, really, really like the Magic record a lot.
Yeah.
You don't want to say it's a comeback album because he's been doing it for so long, but he put out a record with the E Street Band that was just, I have goosebumps thinking about how long and how many times I played that album from front to end. Love it.
This is like, this will blow your mind. This is a statistic that, if you think about it, The post reunion era, the reunion era, 1999 onward, up until 2009, that decade, 99 to 2009, was the most prolific decade of Bruce Springsteen's career. Not his best decade, but it was the most in terms of his output. He put out more records in those 10 years.
They toured crazy
every year of that decade, except for 2001.
Right.
So that is a pretty mind-blowing statistic if you're a Springsteen fan coming out of the 90s, man, and then this reunion happens, and then after the reunion you don't know if they're ever going to come back. They come back with The Rising.
Yeah.
And then he does Devils and Dust and then the Seeger Sessions. And he comes back with Magic and Working on a Dream. Later on, Wrecking Ball, you know, but it was a very prolific decade for Bruce Springsteen.
I easily could have put I'll Work for Your Love, another song on that record that I really like, but Living in the Future to me, it was almost like a prophecy.
Yeah. I mean, scary times that we're living through.
Clarence has a huge sax solo on it, and there's that nice.
It's modeled. I think the structure of that song is modeled on 10th Avenue Freeze Out. It's got that same.
Sure, it does.
Like you can put the two songs together, and you could sing either song on top of the other.
Yeah, there's a structure that's similar to that. I agree, 100%.
It's got that same feel.
Because they
do
have
beat.
That key change and everything. Yeah.
It was classic E Street Band. He was definitely going for when he put Magic out. In October 2007, and I could do that because I'm Rain Man.
He was successful in accomplishing what he set out to do.
Yeah. But my favorites off those records are the political ones, man. The ones where he was going after and just speaking truth to power. And again, people get offended and butthurt anytime an artist speaks truth to power, man. Last to Die is my favorite off that.
It's a good one. You push any kind of button, and it sets off a whole fucking domino effect.
I think Rock Under Fire maybe will be a political podcast in the future, man. Maybe we need to be. While everybody's getting offended over everything, man, maybe that should be our answer to just say, you know.
Enough is enough already.
Enough is enough, man.
All right, so we had Bruce.
Machu Picchu from The Strokes. I'm not going to say, I can't say too much about it. They're a band that when they came out, you thought a lot. You kind of thought for a while that rock and roll was alive and well. And then you had this whole movement of bands that started with the, like the White Stripes and the Vines and the Hives and the this and the that. And they all came out in like within like a year or two, and then they all just kind of disappeared. And The Strokes, you know, a lot of people, well, you know, maybe they shot their load too soon on their first record. I love The Strokes, man. I love every record they put. Well, I don't love every record they put out. I didn't like their third album, but Angles is underrated. Come Down Machine was underrated. That's all I'm going to say about that.
They have some really good records. I agree with you.
They authentically sound underrated. Like the early 80s, man. Like they sound like that their first record sounds like they came out in 1982. Angles, Machu Picchu. You listen to that song, it could have come out of the summer of 1983.
Hmm.
You know, there's a song called Tap Out from the album after that. It just has 1984 written all over it. Just the sound of pop music. They're not really a rock band.
They're probably heavily influenced by that.
They channel sounds, they channel atmosphere. It just sounds authentic. Like yeah. It came out of a different era, man. Like they don't sound like they're imitating that era. They sound like they're channeling it. Like
they got it then.
Like they understand it.
They were paying attention in school. If you go back to some of those 80s rockers.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Like,
the band,
you know, Greta Van Fleet, like they understand that music. They're not imitating that music.
Right.
They did their homework.
They get it.
Mm-hmm. What was your...
we had Elevate by Winery Dogs. Yeah. Now I got to give, I know we've spoken about it all the time.
Great debut album, man.
Oh, it's fantastic. But I found that record through Eddie Trunk, believe it or not, who basically is responsible for putting them together.
Yeah.
Richie Kotzen is obviously, when it comes to guitar players, the guy's just, his solo career is crazy good. The guy's phenomenal. He was in Poison for a spill. And the one record that he's on, the only hit on that record he wrote, Billy Sheehan. Everybody in rock and roll is familiar with Billy Sheehan. You need a bass player called Billy, see what he's doing. Maybe he'll come play with us. That's basically what Billy's about.
You must like dislike 2000s music more than me, because all your artists come out of different eras, yeah. Man. They're all like, everybody's over the age of
Portnoy
50.
Was the 80s or 90s, you know. Dream Theater was Mike Portnoy, the drummer.
Yeah.
But they came together, and man, did they catch lightning in a bottle, because there's nothing bad about that album anywhere. Nothing bad about it anywhere from beginning to end. And, you know, it's funny because I tweeted Eddie Trunk. He never friggin' responded to me. But Elevate made its way to Monday Night Football. You know, they're doing a cutout to a commercial, and Elevate made it to friggin' Monday Night Football. And I was like, wow, that's killer. Here's a good rock and roll song. Borderline metal, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But from the first note of him singing, he almost sounds like Chris Cornell. And I'm like, wow, Richie. And then he doesn't throughout the rest of the record, really. Because he's got some really cool bluesy things that he does with his voice. And they're a three-piece. He's playing guitar and singing and doing some wicked stuff on the guitar. I forgot who I went to see in concert. We went with Motley and Tracy and his wife and a bunch of other people. But I was pushing that album, pushing. It might have been the Black Sabbath show, the reunion show. And I just kept pushing that album. And it caught a little fire, and they had a second album. Just got news that they're going to tour next year, which I'm very excited for. So looking forward to going out and seeing the Winery Dogs and get that first album. It's that good. It really is.
You haven't seen them yet?
No, unfortunately not.
My last one was Transatlanticism by Death Cab for Cutie. I talk about what is the culprit? Who is the culprit for that whole whiny male voice sound? And I kind of locate it at Plink 182. Sorry, Vanessa. But there's also that whole, you know, Death Cab, emo punk.
Is that what that's called?
Also qualify for it, but I don't know that Death Cab is quite emo. I don't know what Death Cab is. Not a big fan of them, but I love. They put out one record in 2003 that I absolutely love, man. It's great from beginning to end. It's just one of those records that it was the second album of the 2000s that I got excited about, and it happened very quickly after the Strokes. There's like maybe four records out of the last 15 years that I really love. One is the Strokes, Is This It? The Shins, a band called The Shins called O Inverted World and Transatlanticism by Death Cab for Cutie. A bunch of love songs, man. A bunch of songs about just longing and just missing someone, or just a you know, just longing for a time back when things were better, or at least in your own mind when things were better. And Transatlanticism, the title track, is just fucking intense, man, beginning to end. It's just that a song that on the surface could be boring. That's the type of a band that they are. They could be boring as fuck if you don't give them a chance. And that song is just, it's just the definition of intense. That's all I'll say. So I, like, again, I'm not a big fan. I don't like much of what they've done, but I love that record. So I'll go to my grave saying that Death Cab Transatlanticism is one of the best albums of the last 15 years. So with that, we have a bonus round.
Bonus round?
Bonus round.
I'm glad, you know, it was funny because you texted me. You're like, hey, let's do a couple more each. I was like, oh, that's cool. And I hit you back with a text so quick because the first one obviously is Cracker. It was off their first record. And Teen Angst just had balls. That song just had balls, man. You know, some of you, I know all our guys are historians that listen to us, and you are. And, you know, they're from the camper van, Beethoven Camp, and they were...
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. They never got to they were a critic. They were a critical darling.
I remember Love.
That was their second record.
Yeah.
You know, Camper Van Beethoven was like the critical darlings. And Cracker was, I think, for a time too. The first time I heard that song, though, Teen Angst, I was just like, what the fuck is this? Went out and bought the record immediately because it was that good. And my band covered it in the 90s. We covered it. It was like 93 or something, 92.
Yeah.
It's just killer, man. And if you listen to the lyrics, they're kind of twisted. You know, what the world needs now is another Frank Sinatra so I can get you in bed. It's just, it's great. It's just fun. And it's Teen Angst.
That one took me back. I do remember that song.
It's a Teen Angst.
I had to, like, when you said it, I was like, okay, I don't know what that is, but
really cool.
I knew who Cracker was.
Yeah, really great guitar lick. And you're right, their second album, Low, on their second album is a really good tune as well.
Yeah.
Kerosene something, or was the second record.
Yeah. I went with a song called, I pulled this one out of my ass, from Boston's third record. We've talked a couple times about the first record, and you've been all about Boston on this show, and you've championed the man, and you've defended them. I like Boston, man. I dare say I love Boston, man. but I bring this up because I haven't really gone to bat for Boston on this show. And now I'm going to. The first album, you can't say enough about. It is what it is. It's overplayed on FM rock radio because it's a staple, because it's that great. Second album, not so much. The title track, Don't Look Back. Great song, one of my very favorite songs ever, probably one of my top three or four, believe it or not, favorite guitar solos ever. Boston's third record, Third Stage, that's the one that I love, man. That's my favorite Boston record, man.
Wow.
Third Stage, beginning to end, seamless, man. It plays as one piece of music as far as I'm concerned. The last song on that record is a song called Holly Ann. And Tom Scholz, in the liner notes, just says just like a little tribute and a look back to something that was beautiful, that once was a time that passed much too quickly. I think he's talking about the 1960s, possibly the counterculture. And lyrically, it has that nod of looking back at the counterculture, man, and maybe in the 80s and certainly in the 70s, they thought something had died. If you look at all the music in the early 70s, especially like 1971, all that stuff, man, it was just lamenting the counterculture, the death of something, the death of a dream, you know. Now, you know, 50 years later, we know that the counterculture won. the hippies won. They turned out to be right about the war. They turned out to be right about drugs. They turned out to be right about women's lib, civil rights, gay rights, man. Yeah, I'm going there. So the hippies won, man, because everything about that time has been fully realized and has become an accepted part of our culture and society, despite people trying to...
It has been accepted, but...
To turn the clock
back. Some of
these
people have just gone a little too far.
Yes, yes.
Taken it over the edge.
Without getting into, you know, without mixing the PC stuff in with that, because I don't think it has anything to do with it. I'm not even politicizing this. I'm just saying it's just as a matter of, I didn't even say left or right. I just said that the counterculture was fully realized.
And I agree. But just some of those people who were in the shadows, I think now are out puffing their chests.
Yeah.
I don't owe them anything. I don't owe anybody anything.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't running around calling people faggot because they're gay. I mean, it's wrong, because I know right from wrong.
Right.
They're gay.
Right.
That's, you know... Or dropping an N-bomb on somebody. No, you know what I mean? There's right and wrong, and that's all there is to it. Yeah. But I agree with you on them winning, because there was just nothing but oppression and people still being beaten in the streets. And and that's black, white, gay, Chinese, doesn't matter.
We still see it today.
We do. There's still some angst there.
Yeah. But I mean, this song is universal. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be about the counterculture. It could be about any relationship or any two people, man, that have that kind of connection, man, and lose that connection. And, you know, there's just a little nod and a wink to that sort of thing.
If anybody ever thought that we weren't heartfelt on this show,
yeah.